Our topic for tonight is the ordination of women rabbis. We're going to focus mainly on the process that Jewish Theological Seminary underwent in making their decision about accepting women into the rabbinical school, although we'll mention in passing some of the other denominations and their record on the subject. The first woman to attend classes at JTS was Henrietta Zold, whose name we know from past lectures, that in 1903 she moved up from Baltimore to New York City, to the Upper West Side, and matriculated as a student at JTS while also holding down a job as the editor at Jewish Publication Society.
Her father was still around then.
Her father had died. Benjamin Zold had already died, and that's why she moved up north. But she matriculated on condition that she not use the knowledge thus gained to seek ordination. It was an explicit stipulation that she shall not use this knowledge to seek ordination. And she was one of the better students that they had at that time.
Among men and women?
Well, she was the only woman, but among the men too, so she was one of the better ones.
She was the smartest woman there?
Yeah. Now, over the next few decades, there were plenty of female students at JTS in the Teachers Institute and in other programs that happened on campus. In 1957, a woman by the name of Gladys Citrin applied for admittance to the rabbinical school, and Louis Finkelstein had to send her a letter of rejection, but a very polite letter of rejection, saying, "We hope you'll continue your studies at the seminary, but in one of our other programs, whether it's the graduate school or the Teachers Institute, but not in the rabbinical academy, not in the rabbinical school." By the late 1960s and early 70s, the number of such women applying to the rabbinical school was on the increase, including Susanna Heschel, but they were all politely rejected and told that they should pursue careers in Jewish public service, in education, but something other than the rabbinate, because the rabbinical school is not open to them. What did these people typically do? So those who were ideologically conservative might wait and hope against hope that a change in policy will develop in time for them to go to rabbinical school and have a career. But if they're not so ideologically committed to the conservative movement, what are their options? Well, you can go elsewhere. So the Reform Movement, Hebrew Union College, admitted Sally Prizand in 1964, and she graduated in 1972 as the first ordained female rabbi in the United States.
1964.
Well, she started through college and graduate school. She was there a long time. And the Reconstructionist College, which was established outside of Philadelphia in 1968, admitted women immediately as a matter of policy. Mordechai Kaplan was... Absolutely.
Yes.
He died in 1983 at the age of 102. So... He said, "We're going to have equal policy. Doesn't matter the gender, men, women, everybody's welcome." And Sandy Eisenberg Sasso was ordained in 1974, the first Reconstructionist female rabbi. So, if a woman wanted to become a rabbi, there were options other than JTS. But for those who were committed to the movement that did not want to be a rebel or a renegade against your denomination, you had to wait your turn. But you didn't know when that turn was coming, because the policy had to change, and it wasn't clear that the faculty was ever going to budge on this issue of female ordination. Okay. So, by the way, who was the first ever woman rabbi? So it's a machlokes among the historians as to who gets the credit for that, but the consensus is that Regina Jonas was the first ever woman rabbi, and that she was a student at the Hochschule für die Wissenschaft des Judentum, the Berlin Liberal Seminary, in the 1920s and 30s, but she was refused ordination by the school on the grounds that it's contrary to the tradition. That despite being a liberal seminary, they refused to ordain her. She wrote her graduation thesis on the legitimacy of women's ordination within halachic sources. So obviously she felt, her conclusion was, it's good, it's kosher, give me the degree. But the school didn't feel the same way. But Max Dinnemann, who was a leading liberal rabbi in Germany, gave her private ordination. Sadly, she was killed at Auschwitz. At the age of 42 in 1944.
Did you get a pulpit?
No, but she ministered to people in various asylums and the like, people on the margins.
The title, when did that controversy evolve, what to call a woman rabbi?
So that's only an Orthodox controversy. In the other denominations, once the permission to enter the school was granted, the title is the same title that the men will get. It's only in the Orthodox world where you have mishigasin about titles. Okay, so...
When you say that, you're referring to the modern Orthodox,
yes. Whatever title they give. So, in 1922, the CCAR already went on record, the Reform Rabbinical Union, went on record as favoring the ordination of women. However, Hebrew Union College took another 40, 50 years to make it happen. Why? Because they felt that the place of a woman was not in the clergy, but elsewhere in Jewish public life, and that the single-gender clergy was to be preferred. So this is the most liberal of all the denominations. Although there are rabbis saying we should be equal and fair, the school doesn't. So that's something that we're going to see happens among the conservatives as well. The school is more hesitant to break from tradition than is the rabbinical union. There's something counterintuitive about that, because you might think that what? That the rabbis are protective of their jobs, and they don't want intrusion from other candidates, then they might lose out on Parnassa. And yet, ironically, no. The rabbis themselves in each denomination were the first ones to say it's the right thing to do, and the schools hesitate because they're the ones who have to confer the degree and receive the backlash. Okay.
Did it turn out that way, that women took the jobs from men?
Not early on. After after they were ordained, we'll see that it was a real a great difficulty for women in the rabbinate to secure pulpits, and certainly to be a senior rabbi, assistant and associate they could get. Senior is a whole other ball game. That the synagogues were reluctant to confer that title upon a woman rabbi. Okay, so in 1972. Gerson Cohen replaces Louis Finkelstein as the chancellor of the seminary. And he is an opponent of the ordination of women, but he's willing to consider the issue. Just for the time being, he wants to maintain...
He was
personally opposed in the beginning, and certainly was organizationally opposed because of fear what would happen to the seminary as an institution if they were to make that such a radical departure from tradition.
He was a part of
And he didn't want to tear the movement apart. His view would evolve, and he'd have a 180-degree flip on this. So, in 1974, he moves in that direction, ever so slightly. The curriculum was reorganized so that a woman could take any class, even in the rabbinical department, as part of their graduate school studies, but they could not progress on an ordination track. So basically, every possible opportunity to learn was available to them, but they were not going to get the religious degree, they were going to get an academic degree only. But that's an important first step in opening up the classes to the ladies. This was on the heels of several important things that we spoke about last few weeks. In 1972, the Ezrat Nashim lobbying group crashed the Rabbinical Assembly Convention and demanded egalitarianism, and they got it a year later, 1973. The Committee on Jewish Law and Standards issues an opinion, a majority opinion at that, that women can be included in a minyan and can be the leaders of the public service. So we see that the movement as a whole is moving. That's the nature of movements. They move. All right? They're not stagnant. They don't stay still. But that's the Rabbinical Assembly and its Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. The United Synagogue, the Synagogal Union, the Federation, they pass a resolution in 1973 encouraging the ordination of women. So things are progressing. However, who holds all the cards? The academic institution. If they don't say yes, it doesn't happen. Simple as that. And historically, what was the most powerful of all the organizational arms of the conservative movement? The seminary, not the United Synagogue and not the Rabbinical Assembly. So in 1975 and 76, the Rabbinical Assembly proposes a resolution at their annual meeting in favor of ordination of women. But each time, the resolution is tabled for fear that it's inappropriate for the rabbinical assembly to encroach upon the turf, the domain of the seminary. That as the academic institution, it's their right to call the shots on who gets a degree, not the rabbi's union. So, Rabbi Fishel Perlmutter, great name, Rabbi Fishel Perlmutter, he was the leader of the pro-ordination faction. He was the big feminist among the rabbis. And he was not going to go down so easily on this issue just because the faculty of the seminary was obscurantist and refusing to budge. Well, he's going to negotiate an agreement with Gerson Cohen to keep progress, some little bit of progress, towards the end game of women rabbis. And it's going to be a commission, a study commission, that's going to take 2 years to issue its report. Now, when you have a commission that takes 2 years to issue a report, what does that usually mean? It means that they're burying the issue, right? Dragging their feet, right. Each side interpreted the commission's work as being hostile to their interests. Those who favored female ordination said, oh, they're going to drag their feet, they're going to bury the issue. Those who were against it, on halachic grounds or whatever, said, oh, it's going to be a rubber stamp in favor of the progressives. Each side was suspicious of the work of this body. Okay, now, who were the leaders of the opposition? Well, within the rabbinate, names that are not especially famous. But within the seminary faculty, the big gedolim, the giants of academic study of Talmud, were opposed to the ordination of women. Most importantly, Saul Lieberman and David Weiss Halivni. And each one on halachic grounds.
Open up his mouth on that. I know that Halivni,
the person I knew on this matter, he was pretty firm. So Lieberman was largely silent, yeah. But everyone knew his position, and he very briefly entered into the fray with a short letter that he wrote that I'll mention about 20 minutes from now. So, an important consideration was mitzvot aseh shazman grama, which I mentioned last week with the issue of women included in a minyan. That positive time-bound commandments, women are exempt according to Talmudic law, and how can a woman participate fully in a minyan if she's exempt because she's not a bar chiyuva, and you need to be a bar chiyuva in order to satisfy the obligations of others. So, for that reason, Professor Israel Frankis, who's still alive, I think he retired not that long ago, he said, quote, a woman can never, not today, not tomorrow, not next year, and not next generation, acquire the status of chiyuvit. Meaning, what Talmudic law is going to remain on the books. And it doesn't matter how progressive we want to be, it's going to remain on the books. And so if this is an obstacle to female ordination, which he obviously thought it was, then it doesn't matter how much time passes, it's irrelevant. The law is the law. And the reason he said not now, not next year, not next generation is because a lot of people assumed that the conservative movement is a traditional movement only in the pace of change, not in the ultimate halakhic outcome, but that the pace of change is slower than among those factions further to the left. But that ultimately they get to the same place as those factions further to the left. And what he's saying is no, there are certain things that just can't happen. And this is one of them. All right. Now, Halivni said that women's ordination, quote, defied a halakha based on revelation as interpreted by the sages throughout the ages, a position to which the seminary is committed from its very inception. So that's very strong language. Revelation, the sages from time immemorial, very powerful language in opposition to ordaining women and making it more than just one issue, but the issue. Was he right about the idea that the seminary, since its inception, was devoted to revelation and the interpretation of the sages?
No.
Well, he's wrong, but you can't blame him for saying this because his relationship with the seminary was basically, he was a colleague disciple of Lieberman, and in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was a core of traditionalists who were ordained by the seminary, who were the disciples of Lieberman, who were very, very frum, and ideologically pure, who had nothing to do with the progress or the progressivism of the rest of the conservative movement and the other parts of the seminary.
Did any of them hold pulpits besides?
Yes, some of them did. I'm going to mention a few by name actually soon. But
this is the 50s?
This is, well, these statements are being made in the mid to late 70s, but the ones who are making these comments are the people who studied under Lieberman in the previous few decades and who really did not go along with the agenda of the other mainstream conservative rabbis.
But we're 40 years later at this point.
Right.
These guys are all dead.
Some of them are still alive.
Okay, so
alive.
They're not really functioning.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Okay, strongly. So it seems to me time is on the side of the left-wingers.
Organizationally, yes. In the grand scheme of Judaism, I don't know, but...
I don't understand how... This became the issue. What happened to Shabbos? What happened to driving? That's
an old cause. It's long been settled. Uh-huh. And it was settled by the people, the lay people. This is something that is determined exclusively by the authority figures, by the rabbis. You know, whether a person drives to shul Shabbos or keeps a level of kashrus that's higher, greater, or lesser, that's the private individual's concern. But you can't manufacture a rabbi. Who can manufacture a rabbi? A school that functions, that has professors and gives diplomas. So that's why this is an issue for the people at the very top. Shabbos is an issue for the people at the bottom. All right. Now, Joel Roth, whose name I mentioned last time, and is still a functioning professor, he came up with the idea that a woman could voluntarily accept all the mitzvot I say, she has man grama, that she should be the functional equivalent of a man halachically. And so if she does that, then all is well, and you can have women rabbis.
What does that have to do with being a rabbi?
So the argument is that if someone cannot fully participate in the prayer services of the synagogue, then in the American synagogue context, such a person couldn't really be a clergyman.
Why?
Because Judaism equals davening. Judaism equals the synagogue.
So
Judaism doesn't equal Targum Mitzvahs.
There are 11 people there, 10 are men, one is a woman.
And she's the rabbi.
And what's the problem?
They didn't think along those lines. But you have to understand, what is Judaism? It's the life of the synagogue, not the life of the home, and not the broader package of mitzvot. American Judaism, American conservative Judaism, is the life of the synagogue.
Well, weren't they already counted to women?
From 1973, yes.
So then what?
Well, because the elite of the seminary never accepted that. And there was no egalitarian minyan until after 1984. So the next person to chime in was Robert Gordas. Now, Robert Gordas was an important professor of Bible at the seminary and a rabbi here, not too far from here. He said the ethical sense demands the ordination of women, and the halakha should be dynamic enough to make that possible. But then again, Bob Gordas was your middle-of-the-road, real, right-down-the-middle conservative rabbi, which means what? That we're going to have fealty to the halakha, but the halakha is pliable. Pliable to what we need. Now, he didn't say how, and he wasn't a big halakhist. He was a Bible professor. So he leaves that to the others to figure out. But as a middle-of-the-road, right-down-the-middle conservative, he says, we should be able to do this and do this within our system. Okay. Now, Judy Hauptman was of the following opinion, that a rabbi just means teacher. It recognizes a level of educational attainment and should be open to all people who are learned, men or women. And she's right on that front, that the name Rav... or means a teacher. It means someone who imparts information or instruction. And so she's on target there. But people didn't listen to that opinion because in the eyes of the American public and certainly the eyes of the seminary elite, a rabbi is much more than that. Not just someone with a body of knowledge. So...
yeah, but wasn't she initially opposed to the rabbi for women? That's why she never got sick from the seminary. She ended up
in Yonkers, yeah.
You know, because at most of those years she was opposed to it. When she was ready to take it, her basically, you opposed it, go find someplace else to get it.
I don't know. So, now, the duties of the modern rabbi changed dramatically. And so many argued that there was a need to overturn gender-specific rabbinate of the past. That, yes, in the old days, maybe it was appropriate for it to be only for men, but today we're in a new world. And the feeling was that the iron gates of the seminary, by the way, how many of you have seen the seminary, have been there, the front of the building? So those big gates, Well, now it's a glass door in the front, but then you have an iron gate inside. It's very intimidating when it's closed, and it looks like you can't get in. And the ivory tower,
thank you,
behind it. But if you've been locked out, if you've been locked out, you feel as though, you know, Judaism didn't want you. This institution that represents Judaism has kept me out.
Yeah. Agreed to it. Did the women sign as an aid at a wedding?
Oh, it's an important question. Very important question. So, in a long responsum about this, written by Joel Roth, he addresses this issue. And although there were many conservative rabbis who were quasi-traditionalist and wanted to keep as much of the halakha as possible, they felt that women should be allowed to sign as edim, to function as witnesses in every capacity, but they recognized that such a radical departure from the earlier iteration of the halakha would offend people and cause problems in the real world, that those who had such documents would be rejected. So therefore, we should have like a generational delay in implementing women as edim, that you could have women as rabbis even before you had women as edim, because time has to pass before people can get accustomed to it, and even then, maybe not, in deference to those who are opposed, and you don't want to create problems for the individual. So he said, for example, that we encourage people to use a ketubah that will be accepted by the Israeli rabbinate. In other words, don't use a heterodox ketubah, even if you're a heterodox Jew, because if you're going to go to Israel, why cause yourself grief? Or if you're going to have divorce, go to a Masada Gittin that the Oilam respects, and don't go to some Chamyankel conservative rabbi, because you don't want a problem for yourself. Even if you think this conservative rabbi is good enough, don't create a problem for yourself.
But if you have conservative signed by a woman.
Yeah.
And you have a divorce years later.
Yeah.
Is that original conservative even considered a conservative? You don't even need a get.
No, you need a get. You need a get.
Because being the kedusha.
The ketubah, the validity of the ketubah has nothing to do with the validity of the kedushin. One has nothing to do with the other. Mm-hmm. It may invalidate the nisuin potentially, but not the kedushin. Okay, so.
But a generation has gone by since this arose, this question, hasn't it?
Yeah, sure. And now women sign all sorts of documents in the conservative movement.
So
they do, yeah. Okay. So opponents of women's ordination claimed that those who were in favor of it were, quote, inclined solely on the basis of sociological norms. In other words, you're caving into feminism. It's not religion, it's feminism. Sociological norms. It's a really nasty accusation to make. But in truth, the opponents of female ordination were themselves prone to sociological arguments, and I'll list three of them. One, the threat to male self-esteem. Two, undermining the image of the rabbi as a father figure. And three, the erotic fantasy of male congregants. Whoa. So all three were mentioned by opponents of women's ordination as being legitimate reasons to oppose any innovation. Okay. All right. Now, so Kona Perlmutter negotiated a compromise in 1977, the 2-year time frame for a committee to study the issue. And this committee was known as the Commission for the Study of the Ordination of Women as Rabbis. Gerson Cohn was the chairman, and Gordon Tucker, my friend from White Plains, was at that time a very young rabbi, and he was the executive director of the commission. So.
Isn't he a reform rabbi now?
No, conservative rabbi. He's a big conservative rabbi in the Temple Israel Center of White Plains. Retiring next month. Yeah, it's good. I have a copy, yeah. So, membership on the commission was not given to presidents of various organizational arms of the movement, like the Sisterhood, or the Men's Club, or this, or the Youth. There are many organizational arms of the conservative movement, and each one has a president, and they fight over everything, over turf wars, all the time. And so Tucker told Cohen, don't put these guys on this commission. Put lay people on who don't have an axe to grind. And what's the criteria for membership? Only two things. One, you self-identify as a conservative Jew. And two, you're open-minded on this issue. That even though you might have an opinion, a preference now, you are open-minded enough that you're willing potentially to change your opinion if you're persuaded by the arguments.
But didn't you say beforehand that the making of a rabbi was from the institution? Why go to lay people?
Okay, so that's going to be a criticism leveled by the opponents of women's ordination against this whole process. So the so what Eli was saying was that if the academic institution makes calls the shots and makes the final decision, why is it that a layman's commission appointed by the rabbinical assembly, why does that have any role whatsoever? And the answer is theoretically it would have no role, but there was a desire not to tear the movement apart and to give people the sense of their inclusion in the process. You never want to alienate people by saying your opinion doesn't matter.
Shalom bias.
Shalom bias.
Advisor.
Advisor, yes, yes. Okay. So those who were against this whole thing thought it was going to be a rubber stamp for the progressives. And so they founded a rump faction and founded a committee called the Committee for the Preservation of Tradition. And they wanted the decision on this issue to be decided by the halachic experts of the Talmud faculty and nobody else. Only the experts of the Talmud faculty. Well, he would be the expert, but it was rabbis in the field who don't like the direction they see this is going, and they say, you know what, the process is bad. The process should only be the guy at the top making the decision. So, Cohen claimed that if the commission were to find that female ordination was against halacha, but they were nonetheless in favor of it, despite it being against halacha, that he would personally veto it. That he would allow halacha to have the trump card. So it's really a question of what does the halacha say? Let's find out. But people were suspicious of that claim, and they were rightfully suspicious, because what is the halacha? Halacha is a phantom. It doesn't really exist. Everybody just has an opinion, and the majority is going to win eventually. Saul Teplitz, an important conservative rabbi at Long Island, so he said the conservative community is not ready for a woman rabbi. Wow. They're not ready. He said, that's what he said. Then, the United Synagogue president said, 90% of our shuls wouldn't hire a woman rabbi. 90%. David Novak, who was in that group of the disciples of Lieberman, who were the real frum ones, was at that time a rabbi in Washington, D.C., then became a professor in Toronto, was a big goin' olam, he's a big scholar. He said, female ordination threatens the continuity of the conservative movement as a form of normative Judaism. That's a very, very strong statement. Because... Now, from the Orthodox point of view, fundamentalist Orthodox point of view, the conservative movement was never normative Judaism. However, that's what you'll get in a young Israel. But if you go out beyond the confines of Orthodoxy and you ask what's normative Judaism, in the 1970s, a conservative synagogue is normative Judaism, whether you like it or not.
But not now, they're
all okay, but then yes. And Novak's point is, if we change too much, too much of a departure from what was... then we're not normative anymore. We're a bunch of rebels and mavericks. Okay. The commission held public hearings all over the country in 7 different cities where mostly it was the feminists who came to speak their mind. Those who were opposed, for the most part, stayed away because, after all, the status quo, the chazaka, was there are no women rabbis. Who wants it? Those who want change. And they came to speak their mind. Halivni criticized this public comment period as being terrible. That's it's an affront to those who take halacha seriously, because that's not how you decide the halacha. The public doesn't get to have a comment period. This is absurdity in his mind. Right, so then the commission paid for a scientific sociological survey, actually two of them. I wonder how much they paid. But the first survey found that a slim majority of the respondents were in favor of a female ordination. And then the second survey was done by Charles Liebman. Now, Charles Liebman was an important sociologist. He was an Orthodox fellow. Taught at YU. He taught at YU. Was one of the leading figures in the study of American Jewish community in the 1960s, 70s. He said the following, that the more religious respondents were opposed to the idea of a woman rabbi, and that they might walk away from the movement. So therefore, even if a slim majority were in favor, the core, those who actually go to shul and participate in the davening and the real religious life of the movement, would be offended by it and might walk away to go to Orthodoxy. So you'd be foolhardy to make a decision that's going to alienate your real base of the population. To some extent, yes. All right. Then, on the other hand, he noted that the young people under the age of 35 tend to be in favor of women rabbis, and so since that's the future, you could argue that maybe you do need to make this change. So an argument goes in both directions. You could either direction you could make a strong argument. Those who were opposed feared the following consequences, some of which came to pass. One, the more religious faculty members would resign from the seminary. In fact, that did happen. Some of them did. Number two, the movement would appear to be the same as reform, or closer to reform. That also, for the most part, has happened, although it took time. I'd say not in 1979 or 1983, but certainly by the 21st century, that has happened. Next point, the traditionalists within the movement would gravitate towards orthodoxy. That for sure happened to many people. And fourthly, the relationship with the religious authorities in Israel would be compromised, and that absolutely happened. Now, the truth of the matter is, the relationship was never good with the religious authorities in Israel. There were only a handful of non-orthodox rabbis who ever were recognized for halachic purposes by the Rabbanut HaRashit from the days of Rav Kook and onward. Only a small handful. But what they were worried about was that letters of Jewish status...
Of
diaspora non-orthodox rabbis who had some shaykhs to the chief rabbinate, yeah. So... this was a real worry that the letters of Jewish status and the like or that the conservative movement would no longer be recognized as a Jewish community for Aliyah purposes. They're worried about these things. Okay, so Cohen said that either way we decide this matter, we're going to tear the movement apart. This is a big problem. We don't agree. We're a big tent, and something's going to divide us. So since disaster is going to strike no matter what we do, let's vote our conscience. Let's do what's right, even if it turns out to be a blunder, institutionally speaking. So in 1978, he personally changed his view from being against ordination of women to being passionately in favor of it. And he felt the following. He said, not in these words, but roughly speaking, that for 80 years the seminary made a big mistake. That the seminary tried to be an academic institution that was aloof to the needs of the Jewish community. That it tried to distance itself from the conservative movement and just be a place of scholarship. But as a result of that aloof attitude, it failed to build up the conservative movement to what it could have been, to its great potential. And as a result, there was schism, that Kaplan broke off to the left, and other people were dissatisfied and went in different directions. And so the movement failed to meet the spiritual needs of its own membership. And the seminary was largely at fault. So the seminary should change its policy and now be at the vanguard of whatever the movement needs. And what it needs? Women rabbis. Okay. Now he then said that reform and orthodoxy are lost to them, to the seminary. Not to Judaism, but to the seminary. This is something that Finkelstein never reconciled himself with. Schechter, Adler, Finkelstein, all were of the opinion that the Jewish Theological Seminary could be a catch-all place that would have the support and allegiance of people of all religious persuasions. Were they right? No, they weren't. For decades and decades, they were wrong. But Gerson Cohen understands the reality and says, the Reform are going to do their thing. The Orthodox don't respect us. They're going to do their thing. We have to do our thing. And what is that? Lead our people and have women rabbis. So the commission had 14 members, and they voted 11-3 in favor of ordaining women. And they brought their findings to the 1979 Rabbinical Assembly Convention, and then the matter was handed off to the faculty, which means that this whole thing didn't mean anything.
Were they going to be different than the Reform?
In that the Reform have no... scruples religiously that they can do whatever they want and not bound by Jewish law, as opposed to the conservative movement, which regards itself as bound by Jewish law, except with the tinkering of their own Committee on Jewish Law and Standards.
So the law is constantly changing.
But in the eyes of the rabbis at the top, especially those who are not phonies and radicals, the law is still the law. It may have been slightly amended to take into consideration sociological needs in America, but the law is the law, whereas the Reform have nothing. So, because the matter was passed off to the seminary faculty, this 2 years of work and back and forth and public comment really didn't amount to much. It's still a divisive issue, and the faculty gets to decide. So the next question is, well, when is the faculty going to decide? there was a vote to be taken in May of 1979, and the opponents thought that Gerson Cohen was going to ram it down their throats. This was going to be like a shotgun wedding. Quick, before anybody has any idea what's going on, they're going to vote on it. So they cried foul. And
was the faculty more traditional, or they were more...
So there was an element, a strong element of traditionalism on the faculty, but the faculty was very large at that point. There was a big school, over 50 members in the voting in the academic senate. So it could go either way. And the students in the school at the time were keeping score. They had score sheets, like, you know, the 1947 UN vote, the Guatemala, this. So they were keeping score of who was going to vote how. Well, Cohen decides, he acquiesces and delays the vote from May 79 to December 1st, 1979. But then the question is, who should vote? So some would say the full academic senate, which means people who teach Bible, teach philosophy, history, and Talmud and the like. Everybody gets to vote. Even if you teach in the graduate school or the college, not even in the rabbinical school, that's a pretty wide body. Others said no, only if you teach in the rabbinical school. And others said no, only if you teach in the Talmud department. So obviously those who wanted only the Talmud department were opposed to this because they figured the frummies are in the Talmud department, and they'll say, hands down, no. Well, 16 faculty members petitioned opposition to this whole process. And Cohen met with them personally to try to make them feel better. But they were not happy with his leadership, and things were getting very dirty. So Cohen worried that this vote might be a vote of confidence or no confidence on his position as the chancellor of the school. So for him, personally, this is now a weighty issue, not just a deep issue in the grand scheme of Judaism, but personally, am I going to lose my job? All right.
You know, he himself, although he came from Borough Park and all that, yet he walked around the seminary bareheaded.
Yeah.
I know that. I've seen it.
Yeah.
The man walked around bare. The first time ever that a person of that stature... comport himself.
he was not along the lines of Finkelstein, we'll put it that way. So in December 18th, 1979, a meeting was held in Queens. I think it was in Kew Garden Hills. And it was called the Conference on Halachic Process. And it was a gathering of all the right-wing conservative rabbis who were opposed to the progressivism of the previous decade of the CJLS and the ordaining women, and they wanted to roll back the clock. They wanted 1950s Judaism. All right? They wanted it back. And so they gathered to share their views, and Saul Lieberman did not attend. However, he wrote a letter in which he congratulated his disciples for gathering together to prevent the last spark of halacha from being extinguished. Now, what does that mean? Hagachelot ha-halacha ha-acharona. Those are the exact Hebrew words. It was written in Hebrew. It tells you that although the man had been teaching at that school for 39 years, it was not his place anymore. They passed him by. And although he may have been comfortable religiously with his own student population in a bygone era, no longer the case. And that the decisions made by the Rabbinical Assembly and the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards over the previous few decades were something that were anathema to him. He wanted nothing to do with it. And the best he could hope for was that a few of his more traditional disciples would get together and be the last line of defense against the total dismemberment of the halachic process. So...
Where was Heschel in this whole thing?
Dead. That reminds me of a time when Mike Breen was calling a Knick game and said, "Where was Kurt Thomas?" And Kurt Thomas was on the bench. So, but no, Heschel died in 72. At December 25th. Okay, so I don't know what his position was on ordaining women, but we do know that his daughter wanted to be a rabbi. So,
his position never became one. His position was horizontal.
Okay, so... now, what happened was that this meeting not only had those who were in favor of the meeting, but the enemy showed up. Now, who was the enemy? Not the Palestinians. Who said the... No. So if this is a gathering of right wingers, who shows up to be the enemy? The progressives. So Ismar Shorsh shows up. He's the next chancellor of the seminary, and in 1986 after Cohen, and he tells Cohen, "I went there just to see what the enemy was thinking." And what happens? Shorsh writes back, "We got to table this vote. We can't do it. Why? Because it'll tear everybody apart." So the faculty voted 25-19 to table the motion with no time frame for a future vote. No time frame. So now at this point, the pro-ordination folks, they're angry. They thought they had something going, and it's just dropped, and with no sign of any possibility of progress. So Cohen throws them a bone, and he establishes Shadar. What is Shadar? It's a religious ministries program in JTS, open to men and women, where you get a degree at the end, a doctor of Hebrew letters and a religious title, but you're not a rabbi. Now, what does this remind you of? The modern Orthodox today, all right? So the liberal Orthodox, you get a title, but you're not a rabbi.
What's your title?
Who knows? So, nobody was impressed by this. This was a half-baked measure, if there ever was such a thing. And so a handful of women joined the program. No one ever graduated from it. Those who were involved in the life of the seminary as graduate students in Talmud study, some of them went on to get PhDs with no religious title. Some of them left and went to other schools, other rabbinical schools. But it was a time of exasperation. We're getting nowhere here. But then things changed. In 1980, the Rabbinical Assembly voted in favor of women rabbis. In 75-76, they had tabled the issue. It's the seminary's domain. In 1980, forget the seminary. We want women rabbis, we'll say they're going to be women rabbis. Wolf Kelman, who was the executive director of the RA, was going around the country whispering in people's ears that maybe privately they'll ordain women rabbis who are qualified, even though the seminary won't give a degree. And then there was talk that the Rabbinical Assembly would establish a Beis Din to give smicha to qualified candidates, and the seminary be damned. Let's say they learned on their own. They had a little blat gemara in the house. Who knows? You don't know. But
do secular authorities recognize that rabbinic degree? Would they be able to accept that from the Rabbinical Assembly?
For what purpose does a secular authority care if you're a rabbi?
Taxes.
Okay, marrying people. So marrying people, what's the deal? In New York City, in order to get a certificate that you're a clergy person to do weddings, you need a letter. You need either one of two things. Either a diploma from a recognized institution that has academic standing, or you need a letter from your shul that says when it was founded, how many board members it has, how many members it has, and that they need you to solemnize marriages. So I remember when I got my certificate, what happened? My smicha certificate was in Hebrew. It's klaf. I don't have an English one. I have no diploma from YU that says I'm a rabbi. I have a klaf. The lady behind the counter can't read that. So I had to get a letter at the time from Parkey Synagogue, signed by the administrator, saying that we were founded in 1890, we have 800 members, we have 23 board members, and we need Hoffman to do weddings. So that's what happened. I don't know, I guess. So in April 1983, the Rabbinical Assembly almost accepted a woman as a member. Who was it? Beverly Magidson, who was a graduate of HUC. And she was functioning as a chaplain somewhere, and she wanted to be a member of the Rabbinical Assembly, because she wasn't reformed by personal inclination. She graduated HUC, but she was a conservative Jew. So she wanted to be a member of the Rabbinical Assembly. In order to vote someone in who was not a graduate of the seminary, you need 3/4 vote, like the Hall of Fame. And the final vote was Lahavdil, to get it to Cooperstown. So the vote was 210-75. 210-75. Is that 3/4? Just a little shy. Okay, like Jim Cott, you'll get it next year, you know? So That scared Gerson Cohen. Because what happens now if there's a woman in the rabbinical assembly, but JTS won't ordain one? That means that who's in charge, really? That the RA is in charge, not the seminary. So he's nervous. And he decides to act. He stuffs a letter in everybody's mailbox in the faculty room saying there's going to be a vote in the fall. And when does he do this? On graduation day, May of 83. Why graduation day? Everybody's already off to Israel on the flight, you know, for vacation. Nobody's around still to fight with him over it. So he, it's a savvy move. He's a good politician. Don't cause a ruckus by putting it in the box 5 weeks earlier. Put it in the box graduation day. In the fall, we'll have a vote. All right.
It wasn't a vote he was calling for. He was just calling for an announcement of a vote.
He was calling for an announcement that there's going to be a vote in October. So why did he act then? There are competing theories. One, the Magidson episode. He didn't want to fall behind the RA. The other is he didn't want to lose the seminary to lose power relative to the other institutions in the movement. And last but not least, and in the lore and the mythology, this is the most important, the death of Saul Lieberman. Saul Lieberman died on an El Al flight from New York to Israel on his way to Pesach in Eretz Yisrael, where he went every year. In the middle of the flight, he died.
How old?
85.
All the Kohanim had to leave?
I guess. All right, so his death is considered the turning point.
Let's put it this way. His ticket was cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, why does the mythology claim that it was his death that decided the issue? Why is that the mythology?
The issue to rest.
All right. No, so the answer is that he was the towering figure in the seminary for the 40 years that he was there. And the seminary had a long history of towering figures of great Talmudic repute and deferring to them on the major issues. So it seemed to many people impossible or improbable that he could still be there with a heartbeat and a woman would step in the door as a student in the rabbinical school and get a diploma that says that they're a rabbi. It was unfathomable that could hold true, and he wasn't going to resign and he wasn't going to be fired. So the only solution, he's no longer among the living. That's the mythology. However, the historians tend to poo-poo that and say it's not the critical issue. So what happened next? The vote is on October 24th, 1983, and some of the Frum members of the faculty boycott. Joel Roth had a stipulation for the vote that if we're going to allow women into the rabbinical school, they have to take a pledge to become fully observant of the mitzvot as would a man be. They take upon the mitzvot aseh shehazman grama. That suggestion was shot down. No. And Judith Hauptman was one of the ones who opposed it, on the grounds that it would create different standards for admission for a man versus a woman. And that's not fair. That's not fair. Or it would create differences between a woman who is obligated and a woman who is not obligated. And what happens if you have 10 people in the room and you have, let's say, 7 men and 3 women, and 2 of the women are like the manly women who have the obligations and 1 is like a woman's woman who doesn't have the obligation? You're going to say there's no minion? No, it's a serious consideration. They didn't want to have a chilukim between this type of woman and that type of woman. No. It's not true. That's not true. So, what was the vote? Final vote was 38-4 with one abstention. One abstention, like Siam in the 47. Amy Eilberg was admitted in 1984 and graduated in 1985. It's a quick turn in the rabbinical school. Now, what happened to her? She was already in school in the Talmud department of the graduate program, so she really had all her credits. All she needed was the imprimatur of being a rabbinical student, and that she got in 1 year, boom, she's out. Now, as a result of this vote, there was a split. The Union for Traditional Conservative Judaism was established. What are what's the acronym for Union for Traditional Conservative Judaism? UTCJ. So today, it's UTJ. Then it was UTCJ. They dropped the conservative in 1990. Why? Because in the beginning, Bereshis Bara, 1984, the idea was that we are a faction of conservative Judaism, and that conservative Judaism should and is really a halachic movement devoted to the good cause of traditional Judaism, but that the majority faction within our camp has done something wrong and we need to call them out on it. And we need to have a something of a separatist group within our broader denomination. 6 years later, 1990, they realize it's bunk. That they're not the same. There's no one more. There's no movement. They're an island unto themselves. It's all Union for Traditional Judaism. What is their place of learning? The Institute for Traditional Judaism, the ITJ, which was in New Jersey. I think it was in Teaneck. I think Teaneck. They gave smicha. I know a few guys who got from there. And they never really had a wide audience. Were never very popular.
That was Halivni Weiss.
Halivni Weiss was their Rebbe. So what happened to Halivni? He resigned from the seminary. He went to Columbia. And he taught at Columbia for 23 years while simultaneously teaching the smicha boys in New Jersey. And then he retired from Columbia and went to Israel. I think he went to Bar Ilan for a little while. He's still alive, but he's not well. He's 91 years old now. So he was the big guddle after Lieberman's passing for those within this broader orbit who felt that the seminary had gone in the wrong direction. Okay. Now, Shorsch, who took over after Gerson Cohn retired, Gerson Cohn got sick with cancer and then retired, and he died at a fairly young age. I think it was in mid-60s when he died. But in 1986, Shorsch took over and was the chancellor for the next 20 years until Arnie Eisen took over in 2006. Shorsch said, looking back on it, that had the movement approved of women's ordination in 1979, when they were on the cusp of doing so, that they would have split the movement down the middle. But because they waited four more years till 1983 and the various politicking in between, as a result, the movement split, but only at the margin. That instead of being 50-50 down the middle were a disaster, it was like 95-5. The vast bulk remained in, and the handful of real frummies left because they were disgruntled. I think he's right. I think that they played their cards the right way, and as a result, only a limited number of people felt alienated and had to go. What changed at JTS as a result of all this? Well, the most important thing was the egalitarian minion was established upstairs in the Women's League room, and that became the popular place to daven. The chapel downstairs, the Stein Chapel, which still exists and always had a traditional service run by the old line faculty of the Talmud department, never instituted any changes. There's no mechitza, but otherwise there's no difference between that and Orthodox davening, and that continued to exist, but almost nobody went there because that style has long since ceased to be represented well at that institution. Okay. Now, I don't know. I think it's more than half.
Yeah,
I think it's more than...
That way for quite a while.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. So what about in the movement itself? After the degree is granted, what's happening to these ladies? Do they get jobs?
Yeah.
So in the 1980s, mid to late 80s, so you're only a handful of women, female rabbis circulating or looking for positions, they're able to get placement as assistants and associates. And the reason why they're able to get that is because, on the whole, the RA has a good placement, had a good placement service, and they were a strong union, and they could get their people jobs. But they couldn't guarantee anyone a senior position, and likely it was going to take some time for any illustrious synagogue to give over their main pulpit chair to a woman. Even in the Reform movement, that was the case. When Sally Prizand graduated in 72, she had a hard time. She worked for the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue as an assistant rabbi. But then, where did she make her career? In Tinton Falls, New Jersey, which is not exactly an illustrious congregation. It's somewhere near Long Branch. It's a little out-of-the-way place. That's what she could get. So this remains an issue in the conservative movement about congregations that have more than 500 family units. Do they hire a woman or not? And it's a topic of conversation where the traditionalists don't want to be bullied into doing the bidding of a progressive rabbinical assembly. But on the other hand, you need to hire somebody. And if they don't, if the placement office doesn't cooperate, then you're out of luck.
What about pay? How do they...
So I don't know much about the issue of pay. I do know that when Julie Schoenfeld took over as the executive director of the rabbinical assembly, that was one of her issues, gender gap in terms of pay. I don't know how that's played itself out over the past decade. What I know is the case now is that the rabbinical assembly is getting weaker and weaker because as there's a decline in the number of conservative shuls, you have an oversupply of rabbis. You don't need so many people. And if the older ones don't retire, the younger ones don't get a position. And so where do they go? The answer is something other than the congregational rabbinate, some other line of work, which they do whatever they can do to get work. But the rabbinical assembly can't force themselves on the congregations like they used to be able to because the congregations are the ones paying the salaries, footing the bill. They're few and far between, and so they call the shots. And many times, they will hire someone who's not a graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. They'll hire a Reform rabbi, a Reconstructionist rabbi, a privately ordained rabbi. They'll do whatever they want. And nobody can tell them boo. Yeah.
One issue, what's the issue with Chazanah?
Right. So the Cantor's Assembly accepted women fairly early on, and the job of a Chazanit is a good job for a Jewish girl. It pays well for little work. You daven two times a week, Friday night and Shabbos morning, and get paid. So it. Okay, so I'll tell you something about the conservative cantorate, and for that matter, it applies to the Reform cantorate and mechilas kavodam for the tape. But it happens to be that the non-Orthodox cantorate, on the whole, is terrible. Why? Now, let me explain why. Forget the Ivra. That's an important point, yes. But, no, there's a bigger issue in play here. If you're a Gera Chassid and you have musical talent, you can't go to the opera. The best you can do is leave Ashdod or Bnei Brak and move to America and get a fancy job in Manhattan as a chazan in a modern Orthodox shul. But, or a Baba Chassid or a Belzer from Borough Park, okay, and become the chazan in New Rochelle. So you can do that. You can go to a modern Orthodox shul, and you haven't burned your bridges with your past.
Oh, you're not?
No, it's perfectly fine. But what you don't do is you don't pull a Richard Tucker and go to the opera. But if you're a heterodox Jew who doesn't have considerations of Shabbos and the like, and you have musical talent, you're going to go into entertainment. Not religious entertainment, but real entertainment. Those who can't make it in real entertainment go into the religion business. I don't mean to disparage anyone, but it's a sociological fact that for this reason, the heterodox cantorate doesn't have as impressive a sounding voice as the gedolim of the Orthodox chazonist world. It's night and day. Now, there were great chazonim in the golden age who were in the conservative shuls. The better chazonim were in the conservative shuls in the golden age. Okay, in the days of David Kusevitsky, in the days of Ganshoff and the like, those were the best chazanim in the world.
Richard Tucker.
Richard Tucker, well, he did the Concord. So that was true back then. But they were trained in Europe, in the old world, and not in a school. The ones who were trained in the American schools are, on the whole, not the most impressive musically. Some of them are very good, but others not. Okay. On that note, we'll stop after the Lashon.